from the servants that she was a fright in her last days. Face all contorted, so that she looked to be grinning like a ghoul, escaping from her sickbed to lurch along the hallways with a great ring of keys in hand, locking all the doors and raving about some secret that no one must know. Mad as a hatter she was in the end, and him not much better. Lord Mantrachet got blood poisoning too? Oh, no, no, not him. Lost his fortune making trips to foreign places. She lowered her voice. Voodoo places. They say he brought back souvenirs that'd make your hair stand on end. Went quite queer, by all accounts. The staff left, all but one kitchen maid and a gardener who'd been there all his life. According to my mum, when the old boy finally died, there was none there to find him for days. Clara smiled so that her eyes concertinaed shut. Eliza got away, though, didn't she? And that's the thing. Travelled across the sea, my mum said. She was always so glad about that. Not to Australia, though, said Cassandra. I don't know where, truth be told, said Clara. I only know what my mum told me, that Eliza got herself away from the horrid house in time. Went away like she'd always planned, and never came back. She held aloft a finger. That's where those sketches came from, the ones the museum lady was so taken with. They were hers, Eliza's. They were amongst her things. It was on the tip of Cassandra's tongue to ask whether Mary had taken them from Eliza, when she caught herself, realized that it might be construed as bad manners to suggest this woman's dearly departed mother had thieved valuable artwork from her employer. Which things? The boxes my mum bought. Now Cassandra really was confused. She bought some boxes from Eliza? Not from Eliza. Of Eliza's. After she was gone. Who did she buy them from? It was a big sale. I remember it myself. My mum took me when I was a girl. It was 1935, and I was 15 years old. After the old lord finally died, a distant family member from up Scotland way decided to sell the estate, hoping to raise some money during the Depression, I don't doubt. Anyhow, my mum read about it in the newspaper and saw that they were planning on selling some of the smaller items, too. I think it gave her pleasure to think she might own a little piece of the place where she'd been treated so poor. She took me along, because she'd said it'd do me good to see where she'd started out. Made me thankful that I wasn't in service, encouraged me to try harder at school, so that I might have more than she did. Can't say it worked, but it certainly did shock me. First time I'd seen anything like it. I'd no idea there were some that lived like that. You don't see much that's grand around these parts. She gave a nod to signal her approval of this state of affairs, then paused and gazed towards the ceiling. Now, where was I? You were telling us about the boxes, prompted Christian. The ones your mother bought from Blackhurst. She lifted a quivering finger. That's right, from the manor up Tregenna way. You should have seen the look on her face when she saw them. Sitting on a table with other odds and ends, lamps, paperweights, books and the like. Didn't look much to me, but Mum knew right away they were Eliza's. She took my hand, first time in my life, I reckon, and it was almost like she couldn't get enough air. I actually started to worry, thought I should get her to a chair, but she wouldn't hear of it. She seized upon those boxes. It was like she was frightened to walk away in case someone else should buy them. Didn't seem likely to me. As I already said, they didn't look like much. But beauty's in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? And the Nathaniel Walker sketches were in the box, said Cassandra, in with Eliza's things. Clara nodded. It's strange, now I recollect it. Mum was so happy to buy them. But when we got home, she had my dad carry them upstairs for her, put them in the attic, and that was the last I heard of them. Not that I thought much of it then. I was 15, probably had my eye on a local lad and couldn't care less about some old boxes my mum had bought. Until she moved in here with me, that is, and I noticed that the boxes came with her. Now, that was funny, and really showed what they meant to her, because she didn't bring much. And it was when we were here together that she finally told me what they were, why they were so important. Cassandra remembered Ruby's account of the room upstairs, still full of Mary's personal items. What other precious clues might be there now, buried in boxes, never to be seen? She swallowed. Did you ever look inside? Clara took a sip of tea, surely cold by now, and fiddled with the cup's handle. I must admit, I did. Cassandra's heart was thumping. She shifted forward. And? Books, mainly. A lamp, like I said. She paused, and a crimson flush cherried her cheeks. Was there something else? Gently, oh so gently. Clara moved the toe of her slipper across the carpet. She watched its progress before looking up. I found a letter in there, too, right near the top. Addressed to my mum, it was, written by a publisher in London. Gave me the shock of my life. I'd never thought of Mum as a writer. Clara cackled, and she wasn't, of course. What was the letter, then? Said Christian. Why had the publisher written to your Mum? Clara blinked. Well, no, it seems my Mum must have sent off one of Eliza's stories. From what I could tell from the letter, she must have found it in the box, amongst Eliza's things, and figured it deserved reading. Turns out, Eliza had written it just before she left on her adventure. Nice story it was, full of hope and happy endings. Cassandra thought of the photocopied article in Nell's notebook. The Cuckoo's Flight, she said. That's the one, said Clara, as pleased as if she'd written a story herself. You've read it, then. I've read of it, but I haven't seen the story itself. It was published years after the rest. That'd be right. It was 1936, according to the letter sent. My mum would have been real pleased with herself about that letter. She would have felt she'd done something for Eliza. She missed her after she was gone, and that's a fact. Cassandra nodded. She could almost taste the solution to Nell's mystery. They had a bond, didn't they? That they did. What do you think it was that tied them together like that? She bit her lip, paced herself. Clara knotted her gnarled fingers in her lap and lowered her voice. The two of them were party to something that no one else knew about. Something inside Cassandra released. Her voice was faint. What was it? What did your mum tell you? It was in my mum's last days. She kept saying something awful had been done, and those what had done it thought they'd got away with it. She said it over and over. And what do you think she meant? At first, I didn't think much of it at all. She was often saying strange things towards the end, insulting our dear old friends. She really wasn't herself anymore. But she went on and on. "It's all in the story," she kept saying. "They took it from the young girl and made her go without." I didn't know what she was talking about, what story she was on about. And in the end, it didn't matter. She told me straight. Clara drew breath, shook her head sadly at Cassandra. Rose Mountrachet wasn't the mother of that little girl, of your grandmother. Cassandra sighed with relief. Finally, the truth. "I know," she said, taking Clara's hands. "Nell was Mary's baby, the pregnancy that got her fired." Clara's expression was difficult to read. She looked between Christian and Cassandra, eyes twitching at the corners, blinked confusedly, then started to laugh. "What?" said Cassandra with some alarm. "What's so funny? Are you all right?"
"My mum was pregnant, that's right enough. But she never had a baby. Not then. She lost it around 12 weeks.
"What?"
"That's what I'm trying to tell you. Nell wasn't Mum's baby. She was Eliza's."
Eliza was pregnant. Cassandra unwrapped her scarf and put it on top of her bag on the floor of the car.
"Eliza was pregnant."
Christian tapped his gloved hands on the steering wheel. The car heating was turned on, and the radiator whirred and ticked as they left Polperro behind them. The fog had come in while they were visiting Clara, and all the way along the coast road, muffled boat lights bobbed on the ghostly tide. Cassandra stared blankly ahead, her brain as foggy as the world outside the windscreen. Eliza was pregnant. She was Nell's mother. That's why Eliza took her. Perhaps if she said it enough times, it would make more sense.
"That seems to be about it."
She leaned her head to one side and rubbed her neck. "But I don't understand. It all added up before, when it was Mary. Now that it's Eliza, I can't see how Rose ended up with Ivory. Why did Eliza let her keep her? And how did no one ever find out?"
"Except Mary."
"Except Mary."
"I suppose they kept it quiet."
"Eliza's family?"
He nodded. "She was single, young, their ward, so their responsibility. And then she fell pregnant. It wouldn't have looked good."
"Who was the father?"
Christian shrugged. "Some local guy? Did she have a boyfriend?"
"I don't know. She was friends with Mary's brother, William. It said so in Nell's notebook. They were close until they had some kind of argument. Maybe it was him."
"Who knows? I suppose it doesn't really matter."
He glanced at her. "I mean, it does, of course, to Nell and to you, but for the sake of this argument, all that matters is that she was pregnant and Rose wasn't." "So they convinced Eliza to give her baby to Rose."
"It would have been easier for everyone." "That's debatable." "I mean, socially. Then Rose died.
And Eliza took her child back." "That makes sense." Cassandra watched the fog billowing amongst the long grass on the roadside. "But why didn't she go on the ship to Australia with Nell? Why would a woman take back her child, then send her on a long and treacherous journey to a foreign land, alone?" Cassandra sighed heavily. "It's like the closer we get, the more tangled the web becomes."
"Maybe she did go with her. Maybe something happened to her en route. Illness of some kind." Clara seemed certain that she went. But Nell remembered Eliza putting her on the boat and telling her to wait, leaving and then not coming back. It was one of the only things she was sure about. Cassandra chewed her thumbnail. How bloody frustrating. I thought we'd be getting answers today, not more questions. One thing's for sure. The golden egg wasn't about Mary. Eliza wrote it about herself. She was the maiden in the cottage. Poor Eliza, said Cassandra, as the gloomy world drifted by outside. The maiden's life, after she gives away the egg, is so desolate. Yes. Cassandra shivered. She understood loss that took away a person's very purpose, left her paler, lighter, emptier. No wonder she took Nell back when she had the chance. What wouldn't Cassandra have done for a second chance? Which brings us full circle. If she'd just reclaimed her daughter, why didn't Eliza go with her on the boat? Cassandra shook her head. I don't know, it makes no sense. They drove past the sign welcoming them to Tregenna, and Christian turned off the main road. You know what I reckon? What's that? Said Cassandra. We should get some late lunch at the pub, talk it over some more, see if we can't figure it out. I'm sure beer will help us. Cassandra smiled. Yeah, I usually find beer just the thing to make my mind nimble. All right if we stop by the hotel so I can get my jacket? Christian took the high road through the woods and turned into the entrance to the Hotel Blackhurst. Fog lurked still and moist in the gullies of the driveway, and he went carefully. Back in a sec, said Cassandra, slamming the car door behind her. She ran up the stairs and into the foyer. Hi, Sam, she called, waving at the receptionist. Hiya, Cass. There is someone here to see you. Cassandra stopped mid-flight. Robin Jameson's been waiting in the lounge for the past half hour or so. Cassandra glanced back outside. Christian's attention was absorbed in tuning his car radio. He wouldn't mind waiting an extra minute. Cassandra couldn't think what Robin might have to tell her, but she didn't imagine it would take much time. Well, hello, said Robin when she noticed Cassandra's approach. A little birdie tells me you've spent the morning chatting with my second cousin, Clara. The network of country gossip was pretty impressive. I have indeed. I trust you had a lovely time. I did, thanks. I hope you haven't been waiting too long. Not at all. I have something for you. I suppose I could have left it at the desk, but I thought it might require a little explanation. Cassandra raised her eyebrows as Robin continued. I went to visit my dad at the weekend, up at the retirement home. He likes to hear all about the comings and goings in the old village. He was postmaster once, you know. And I happened to mention that you were here, restoring the cottage that your grandma left you, up there on the cliff. Funniest look came across Dad's face. He may be old, but he's sharp as a tack, just like his own dad before him. He took my arm and told me there was a letter needed to be returned to you. To me? To your grandma, more properly, but seeing as she's no longer with us, to you. What sort of letter? When your grandma left Tregenna, she went to see my dad. Told him she'd be returning to take up residence at Cliff Cottage, and he was to hold any mail for her. She was very clear about it, he said. So when a letter arrived, he did as she asked, and kept it at the post office. Every few months or so, he took the letter up the hill, but the old cottage was always deserted. The brambles grew, the dust settled, and the place looked less and less inhabited. Eventually, he stopped going. His knees were giving him trouble, and he figured your grandma would come and see him when she got back. Ordinarily, he'd have returned it to the sender, but your grandma had been very definite. So he tucked the letter away and kept it all that time. He told me I was to go down to the cellar where his things are stored and pull out the box of lost letters. That in amongst them, I'd find one addressed to Nell Andrews, Tregenna Inn, received November 1975. And he was right. It was there, waiting. She reached into her handbag and withdrew a small grey envelope, gave it to Cassandra. The paper was cheap, so thin it was almost transparent. It was addressed in old-fashioned writing, rather messy, first to a hotel in London, then redirected to the Tregenna Inn. Cassandra flipped the envelope. There, in the same hand, was written, "Sender, Miss Harriet Swindle, 37 Battersea Church Road, London, SW11. Cassandra remembered Nell's notebook entry. Harriet Swindle was the woman she had visited in London, the old woman who had been born and grown up in the same house as Eliza. Why had she written to Nell? Fingers trembling, Cassandra opened the envelope. The thin paper tore softly. She unfolded the letter and began to read. 3rd of November, 1975. Dear Mrs. Andrews, well, I don't mind saying that ever since you made your visit, asking about the fairy tale lady, I've been hard-pressed to think of much else. You'll find it yourself when you get to my age. The past turns into something of an old friend. The sort who arrives uninvited and refuses to leave. I do remember her, you see. I remember her well. Only you caught me unawares with your visit, turning up on the doorstep right as it was on tea time. I weren't sure whether I felt like talking over the old days with a stranger. My niece, Nancy, tells me that I ought, though, that it all happened so long ago it hardly matters now. So I've decided to write to you, as you asked. For Eliza Makepeace did return to visit with my ma. Only the once, mind you, but I recall it well enough. I was 16 at the time, and that's how I know it must have been 1913. I remember thinking there was something strange about her from the first. She might have had the clean clothes of a lady, but there was something about her that didn't quite fit. More rightly, there was something about her that did fit with us at 35 Battersea Church Road. Something that set her apart from the other fancy ladies what might be seen in the streets back then. She came through the door and into the shop, a bit agitated, it seemed to me, as if she was in a hurry and didn't want to be seen. Suspicious-like. She nodded at my ma as if they was known, one to the other, and ma, for her part, gave her a smile, a sight the likes of which I never seen too often. Whoever this lady was, I thought to myself, my ma must have known she could make a quid off her acquaintance. Her voice, when she spoke, was clear and musical. That was the first sign to me that I might have met her before. It was familiar, somehow. That voice was the sort what children like to listen to, what speaks of fairies and sprites, and leaves no doubt in the mind as to their truth. She thanked my ma for seeing her, and said she was leaving England and wouldn't be back for some years. I remember she were awful keen to go upstairs and visit the room she used to live in. Horrid little room at the top of the house. Cold it was, with a fireplace what never worked, and dark. Not a window to be spoke of. But she said it was for old time's sake. It so happened that Ma didn't have a tenant at the time. Nasty dispute about rent owing. So she were glad enough to let the lady make a visit. Ma told her to go upstairs and take her time, even put the kettle on to boil. As unlike my Ma, as you could find. Ma watched as she climbed those stairs. Then she beckoned me quick. Get upstairs after her, Ma said, and make sure she don't come down too soon. I was used to Ma's instructions and her punishments if I refused, so I did what she said and followed the lady upstairs. By the time I got to the landing, she pulled the door to the room closed behind her. I could have just sat where I was and made sure she didn't decide to return downstairs too fast, but I was curious. I couldn't for the life of me figure out why she'd have closed the door. Like I said, there was no windows in that room, and the door was the only way to let light in. There were a hole in the bottom of that door, eaten by rats, so I lay down on my stomach, flat as can be, and I watched her. I watched her as she stood in the middle of the room, turning around to take it all in, and I watched as she went to the old broken fireplace, sat herself down on a ledge she did, and reached her arm up inside, then sat like that for what seemed an age. Finally, she withdrew her arm, and in her hand was a small clay pot. I must have made a sound then, I was that surprised, for she looked up, eyes wide. I held my breath, and after a time, she returned her attention to the pot, held it to her ear, and gave it a little shake. I could tell by her face she was pleased with what she heard. Then she tucked it inside a special pocket what was sewn into her dress somehow, and started towards the door. I hurried down then and told my ma that she were coming. I was surprised to see that Tom, my little brother, was standing at the door, heaving great sighs as if he'd run some distance, but I didn't have time to ask where he'd been. Ma were watching the stairs, so I did the same. Down the lady started, thanking my ma for letting her visit and saying that she couldn't stay for tea, as time was pressing. Then she reached the bottom, and I saw there were a man standing in the shadows at the side of the stairs. A man with funny little spectacles, the type what don't have arms, just a little bridging piece what pinches the nose. He were holding a sponge in his hand, and when she got to the bottom step, he clamped it under her nose, and she collapsed. Instant-like, crumpled into his arms. I must have hollered out then, because I earned a slap across the face from my ma. The man ignored me and dragged the lady to the door. With Pa's help, he lifted her into the carriage. Then he nodded at my ma, handed her an envelope from his breast pocket, and away they went. I got a clip around the ears later when I told my ma all what I'd seen. "Why didn't you tell me, you stupid girl?" said my ma. "Could have been valuable. We might have had it for our troubles." Wouldn't have done to remind Mama that the man with the black horses had already paid her handsome for the lady. As far as my ma were concerned, there were never enough coin to be had. I never seen the lady again, and I don't know what become of her after she left us. There was always things happening on our bend of the river, things what didn't bear remembering. I don't know much that this letter will help you if you're a search, but Nancy said it was as well to talk to you as not. So that's what I've done. I hope you find what it is you're looking for. Yours, Miss Harriet Swindle.
Chapter 47. Brisbane, 1976. The Fairyland Lustre Vase had always been her favourite. Nell had found it at a trash and treasure stall decades before. Any antiques dealer worth her salt would have known its worth, but the Fairyland Lustre Vase was different. It wasn't the material value, though that was high enough. It was what it represented. The first time Nell had struck gold in unlikely surroundings. And like a gold miner who keeps his first nugget, whatever its value, Nell had been unwilling to part with the vase. She kept it wrapped in a towel, stowed safely in the dark corner at the very top of her linen cupboard. And every so often, she would pull it out and unwrap it, just to take a peek. Its beauty. The deep green leaves painted on the side. The gold threads running through the design. The Art Nouveau fairies hidden amongst the foliage had the power to cool her skin. Nonetheless, Nell was resolute. She had reached a point where she could live without her vase, could live without all her precious things. She'd made a choice, and that was that. She wrapped the vase in another layer of newspaper and placed it gently in the box with the others. Up to the shop on Monday, and priced to sell. And if she had twinges or regrets, she just had to focus on the end result, having sufficient funds to start afresh in Tregenna. She was itching to return. Her mystery grew ever more perplexing. She had heard finally from the detective, Ned Morrish. He'd conducted his investigation and sent her a report. Nell had been in the shop when it arrived. A new customer, Ben something or other, had brought the letter in with him when he came. When Nell saw the foreign stamps, the handwriting on the front, neat and flat at the bottom, as if written along a ruler's edge, she'd felt a flush beneath her skin. It was all she could do not to tear it open with her teeth, then and there. She'd retained her composure, though, made her excuses when it seemed polite, and taken the letter into the little back kitchenette. The report was brief, had only taken Nell a couple of minutes to read, and its contents left her more confused than ever. According to Mr. Morrish's investigations, Eliza Makepeace had gone nowhere in 1909 or 1910. She had been at the cottage the whole time. He'd included various documents to support this assertion, an interview conducted with someone who claimed to have worked at Blackhurst, various correspondence she'd had with a publisher in London, all sent and received via Cliff Cottage. But Nell hadn't read those, not until later. She'd been too surprised by the news that Eliza hadn't gone away, that she'd been there all along, in the cottage the entire time. William had been so certain. She'd slipped from public sight, he said, for 12 months or so. When she returned, she'd been different. Some spark had been missing. Nell couldn't understand how William's memories could be made to tally with Mr. Morrish's discovery. As soon as she got back to Cornwall, she would speak with William again, see whether he had any ideas. Nell wiped the back of her hand across her forehead. A stinker of a day, but that was Brisbane in January. The skies might be glistening blue like a dome of fine, flawless glass, but there'd be a storm later tonight. There was no doubting that. Nell had lived long enough to know when angry clouds were thickening in the wings. Down in the street, Nell heard a car slow. She didn't recognize it as one of her neighbor's vehicles. Too loud for Howard's Mini. Too high-pitched for the Hogan's big Ford. There was a dreadful din as the car mounted the curb too sharply. Nell shook her head, glad she'd never learned to drive. Never had need of a car. They seemed to bring out the worst in people. Whiskers sat upright and arched her back. Now the cats, Nell would miss. She'd have happily taken them with her, but feeding other people's cats was one thing. Abducting them, quite another. "Hey there, Nosy," said Nell, tickling the cat beneath her chin. "Don't you go worrying about that noisy old car." Whiskers meowed and leapt from the table, glanced at Nell. "What? You think there's someone here to see us?" "Can't think who, my dear. We're not exactly social central, in case the fact escaped your notice." The cat slunk across the floor and out of the back door. Nell dropped the pile of newspaper. "Oh, all right, madam," she said. "You win. I'll have a gander." She scratched Whiskers' back as they went along the narrow concrete path. "Think you're clever, don't you? Bending me to your will." Nell stopped at the back corner of the house. The car, a station wagon, had indeed stopped outside her place. Coming up the cement path was a woman wearing large bronze sunglasses and tiny shorts. Lagging behind was a skinny child with slumped shoulders. They stood, all three, regarding one another for a time. Finally, Nell found her voice, if not the words she wished to speak. "I thought you agreed to call first in future."
"Good to see you too, Mum," Leslie said, and then she rolled her eyes the way she had as a 15-year-old. It had been an infuriating habit then, as was it now.
Nell felt the old grievances resurfacing. She'd been a poor mother to Leslie, she knew that, but it was too late now to make amends. What was done, and Leslie had turned out all right. Had turned out, at any rate. "I'm in the middle of sorting boxes for auction," said Nell, swallowing the lump in her throat. This wasn't the time to mention the move to England. "I've things everywhere. There's no room to sit."
"We'll manage."
Leslie flicked her fingers in the girl's direction. "Your granddaughter's thirsty. It's bloody hot out here." Nell looked at the girl, her granddaughter. Long limbs, knobbly knees, head bowed to avoid notice. There was no doubt about it. Some children were sent into the world with more than their fair share of difficulties. Of all things, her mind tossed up an image then of Christian, the little boy she'd discovered in her Cornish garden, the motherless boy with the earnest brown eyes. "Does your granddaughter like gardens?" he'd asked, and she, Nell, had not known how to answer. "All right, then," she said. "You'd better come inside." Chapter 48, Blackhurst Manor, 1913. Horses' hooves thundered against the cold, dry earth, charging west towards Blackhurst, but Eliza didn't hear them. Mr. Mansell's sponge had done its work, and she was lost in a fog of chloroform, her body slumped in the dark corner of the carriage. Rose's voice, soft and broken. "There is something I need, something only you can do. My body fails me, as it has always done, but yours, cousin, is strong. I need you to have a child for me, Nathaniel's child." And Eliza, who had waited so long, who wanted so desperately to be needed, who had always known herself a half in search of a double, didn't have to think. "Of course," she'd said. "Of course I'll help you, Rose." He came every night for a week. Aunt Adeline, with Dr. Matthews's counsel, calculated the dates, and Nathaniel did as he was bidden. Made his way through the maze, around the side of the cottage, and up to Eliza's front door. On the first night, Eliza waited inside, pacing the kitchen floor, wondering whether he would arrive, whether she should have prepared something, wondering how people behaved at such a time. She had agreed to Rose's request without hesitation, and in the weeks that followed had thought little about what the commitment would involve. She had been too full of gratitude that Rose finally needed her. It was only as the day drew nearer that she began to contemplate the hypothetical becoming actual. And yet there was nothing she would not do for Rose. She told herself over and over that her actions would cement their bond forever, no matter how hideous the unknown act might be. It became a mantra of sorts, an incantation. She and Rose would be tied like never before. Rose would love her more than she ever had, would not dispense with her so easily again. It was all for Rose. When the knock came that first night, Eliza repeated the mantra, opened the door, and let Nathaniel inside. He stood for a time in the hallway, larger than she remembered, darker, until Eliza indicated the coat hook. He removed his outer layer, then he smiled at her, almost gratefully. It was then that she realized he was as disquieted as she. He followed her to the kitchen, gravitated towards the security, the solidity of the table, leaned on the back of a chair. Eliza stood on the other side, wiped clean hands against her skirts, wondered what to say, how to proceed. It was best, surely, to do what was necessary and be done with it. There was no point in drawing out the discomfort. She opened her mouth to say as much, but Nathaniel was already speaking. "Thought you might like to see. I've been working on them all month." She noticed then that he carried with him a leather satchel. He laid it on the table and slid a stack of papers from within. Sketches, Eliza realized. "I started with the fairy hunt." He thrust a sheet of paper before Eliza, and when she took it from him, she saw that his hands were quivering. Eliza's gaze fell to the illustration. Black strokes, cross-hatched shadows. A pale, thin woman reclined on a low bed in a cold, dark turret. The woman's face had been spun from lean, long lines. She was beautiful, magical, elusive, just as Eliza's fairy tale described her. And yet it was something else in Nathaniel's rendering of the hunted fairy's face that struck Eliza. The woman in the picture looked like Mother. Not literally. It was something more and less than the curve of her lips, the cool almond eyes, the high cheekbones. In some indescribable way, by some form of magic, Nathaniel had captured Georgiana in his depiction of the fairy's lifeless limbs, her weariness, the uncharacteristic resignation in her features. Strangest of all, it was the first time Eliza had realized that in her story of the hunted fairy, she had been describing her own mother. She glanced up at him, scanned the dark eyes that had looked somehow inside her soul. As he held her gaze, the firelight was suddenly warmer between them. Circumstance heightened everything. Their voices were too loud, their movements too sudden, the air too cool. The act was not hideous, as she had feared, nor was it ordinary. And there was something unexpected in its performance, which she couldn't help but savor. A closeness, an intimacy of which she had been deprived for so long. She felt part of a pair. She wasn't, of course, and it was a betrayal of Rose even to entertain such a notion, however briefly. And yet, his fingertips on her back, her side, her thigh, the warmth where their bare bodies met, his breath on her neck. She opened her eyes at one point and watched his face, the expressions and stories arranging themselves on his features. And when his own eyes opened, his gaze locked with hers, she sensed herself suddenly, unexpectedly, as a physical being, anchored, solid, real. And then it was over, and they moved apart. The bond of physical connectedness evaporated. They dressed, and she walked him downstairs. Stood beside him by the front door, making conversation about the recent high tide, the likelihood of bad weather in the coming weeks. Polite chatter, as if he had no more than stopped by to borrow a book. Eventually his hand reached out to unlatch the door, and heavy silence sagged between them. The weight of what they had done. He pulled open the door, pushed it closed again, turned back to face her. "Thank you," he said. She nodded. "Rose wants... her need is..." She nodded again. And he smiled slightly, opened the door, and disappeared into the night. As the week wore on, the unusual became usual, and they settled into a routine. Nathaniel would arrive with his most recent sketches, and together they would discuss the stories, the illustrations. He brought his pencils, too, made alterations as they spoke. Often, when the sketches were complete, their conversation moved to other topics. They spoke, too, as they lay together in Eliza's narrow bed. Nathaniel told stories of the family Eliza had believed dead, the hardship of his youth, his father on the wharf, and his mother's hands, chapped from laundry. And Eliza found herself telling him things of which she had never spoken, secret things from before, about mother and the father she'd never known, her dreams of following him across the high seas. Such was the strange and unexpected intimacy of their connection, she even spoke of Sammy. Thus the week passed, and on the final night, Nathaniel arrived earlier. He seemed reluctant to do what they must. They sat on opposite sides of the table as they had the first night, but no words were exchanged. Then suddenly, without warning, Nathaniel reached out and lifted a strand of her long hair. Red turned to gold by the glow of candlelight. His face, as he looked at the threads between his fingers, was focused. Dark hair fell to shadow his cheek, and his black eyes widened with unspoken thoughts. Eliza suffered a sudden warm tightness in her chest. "I don't want it to end," he said finally, softly. "It's foolish, I know, but I feel..." He paused as Eliza lifted her finger and pressed it to his lips, silenced him. Her own heart hammered beneath her dress, and she prayed he could not tell. He must not be allowed to finish his sentence, dearly though some disloyal part of her longed it, for words have power. Eliza knew that better than most. Already they had allowed themselves to feel too much, and there was no room in their arrangement for feeling. She shook her head lightly, and finally he nodded, refused to look at her for a time, said no more. And as he set about sketching in silence, Eliza suppressed the burning urge to tell him she had changed her mind. When he left that night and Eliza went inside, the cottage walls seemed unusually silent and lifeless. She found a piece of card on the table where Nathaniel had been sitting, turned it over and saw her own face. A sketch. And for once, she didn't mind having been captured on paper. Eliza knew they had succeeded even before the first month passed. An inexplicable sense of having company, even when she knew herself to be alone. Then her bleeding stayed away, and she knew for certain. Mary, who had lost her own baby, had been reinstated at Blackhurst on a provisional basis and instructed to liaise between the house and the cottage. When Eliza told her, yes, that she believed a small life clung within her body, Mary sighed and shook her head, then took the message back to Aunt Adeline. A wall was built around the cottage so that when Eliza's belly began to swell, no one would see. Word spread that she had gone away, and the world closed over the cottage. The simplest falsehoods are the strongest, and this one performed perfectly. Eliza's desire to travel was well known. It wasn't a stretch for people to believe that she had left without a word, would be back when time suited. Mary was sent nightly with provisions, and Dr. Matthews, Aunt Adeline's physician, attended every 2 weeks, under Knight's black veil, to ensure the pregnancy's health. During the months of confinement, Eliza saw few other people, and yet she never felt alone. She sang to her swelling stomach, whispered stories, had strange and vibrant dreams. The cottage seemed to shrink around her, like a warm old coat. And the garden, a place where her heart had always sung, was more beautiful than ever. The flowers smelled sweeter, looked brighter, grew faster. One day when she was sitting beneath the apple tree and the warm, sunny air moved heavily around her, she fell into a deep sleep. While she softly slumbered, a story came to her, as vividly as if some passing stranger had knelt by her ear and whispered their tale. A tale about a young woman who overcame her fears and traveled a great distance in order to uncover the truth for an aging loved one. Eliza woke suddenly, gripped with certainty that the dream was important, that it must be turned to fairy tale. Unlike most dream inspirations, the tale required little manipulation. The child, the baby inside her, was central to the story, too. Eliza couldn't explain how she knew, but she had the oddest certainty that the baby was connected in some way to the tale, had helped her to receive the story so vividly, so completely. Eliza wrote the fairy tale that afternoon, named it The Crone's Eyes, and throughout the following weeks found herself wondering often about the sad old woman whose truth had been stolen from her. Though she had not seen Nathaniel since the night of their final meeting, Eliza knew he was still working on the illustrations for her book, and she longed to see those that her new tale inspired. One dark night, when Mary brought her supplies, Eliza asked after him, kept her tone even, as she asked whether perhaps Mary might let him know that he may visit her sometime soon. Mary only shook her head.
"Mrs. Walker won't have it," she said, lowering her voice, though they were alone in the cottage. "I heard her crying to the mistress about it, and the mistress was saying it wasn't right for him to be going through the maze, going to see you. Not any more. Not after what has happened." She glanced at Eliza's swelling stomach. "Things might become confused," she said.
"But that's ridiculous," said Eliza. "What was done for Rose. Both Nathaniel and I love her. We did as she requested, to provide her that for which she longs more than anything else."
Mary, who had made quite clear her own opinions about what Eliza had done, what she intended to do after the child was born, remained silent. Eliza sighed, frustrated.
"I wish only to speak with him about the illustrations for the fairy tales."
"That's another thing Mrs. Walker isn't too happy about," said Mary. "She doesn't like him drawing for your stories."
"Why ever would she mind?"
"Jealous, she is, green as old Davy's thumb. Can't bear to think of him spending his time and energy thinking about your stories."
Eliza stopped waiting for Nathaniel after that. She sent her handwritten version of The Crone's Eyes back to Blackhurst with Mary, who agreed, against her better judgment, she said, to deliver it. A gift arrived by courier some days later, a statue for her garden, a little boy with an angel's face. Eliza knew, even without reading the accompanying letter, that Nathaniel had sent it with Sammy in mind. In the letter, he had also apologized for not visiting, made inquiries after her health, then moved quickly on to how much he loved the new story, how its magic had overtaken his thoughts, that ideas for the illustrations overwhelmed him, so that he could bear to think of nothing else. Rose herself came once a month, but Eliza grew to receive such visits cautiously. Things always started well. Rose would smile broadly when she saw Eliza, inquire after her health, and leap at the opportunity to feel the baby moving beneath her skin. But at some point in the visit, with neither warning nor provocation, Rose would recoil inexplicably, knot her hands, and refuse to touch Eliza's stomach anymore, refuse even to meet her eye. Her fingers would pluck instead at her own dress, padded to suggest a pregnancy. After the sixth month, Rose stopped coming altogether. Eliza waited in vain on the allotted day, confused, wondering whether she had mistaken the date somehow. But there it was in her diary. Her first fear was that Rose had taken ill, for surely nothing less would keep her from visiting.
When Mary next arrived with her basket of supplies, Eliza pounced. Mary laid down the basket and set the kettle on the hot plate. Didn't answer for a time.
"Mary?" said Eliza, arching her back to shift the baby who was pressing against her side. "You mustn't try to protect me. If Rose is unwell..."
"It's nothing like that, Miss Eliza."
Mary turned from the range.
"Only Mrs. Walker finds it too distressing to visit."
"Distressing?"
Mary didn't meet Eliza's eyes.
"It makes her feel a failure, even more than before. She unable to fall, and you looking ripe as a peach. After her visits, she returns home and is unwell for days. Won't see Mr. Walker, snaps at the mistress, picks at her food."
"Then I look forward to the child's arrival. When I deliver the baby, when Rose is a mother, then she will forget such feelings."
And like that, they were back in familiar waters, Mary shaking her head and Eliza defending her decision.
"It isn't right, Miss Eliza. A mother can't just give up her child."
"It's not my child, Mary. It belongs to Rose."
"You might feel differently when the time comes."
"I won't."
"You don't know."
"I won't feel differently because I can't. I've given my word. If I were to change my mind, Rose would never bear it."
Mary raised her eyebrows. Eliza forced further determination into her voice.
"I will hand over the child and Rose will be happy again. We will be happy together, just as we used to be long ago."
"Can't you see, Mary? This child I carry will return my Rose to me."
Mary smiled sadly.
"Perhaps you're right, Miss Eliza," she said, though she didn't sound as if she believed it.
Then, after months in which time seemed to pause, the end arrived, 2 weeks earlier than expected. Pain, blinding pain, the body like a piece of machinery creaking to life to do that for which it had been created. Mary, who had recognized the signs of impending birth, made sure she was there to help. Her ma had delivered babies all her life, and Mary knew how it was done. The birth went smoothly, and the child was the most beautiful Eliza had ever seen, a little girl with tiny ears pressed neatly against her head and fine pale fingers that startled periodically at the sensation of air passing between them. Though Mary had been ordered to report to Blackhurst immediately on any sign of the baby's imminent arrival, she remained silent in the days after. Spoke only to Eliza, urging her to reconsider her part in the dreadful pact. For it wasn't right, Mary whispered over and again, that a woman be asked to forsake her own child. For 3 days and nights, Eliza and the baby were alone together. How strange it was to meet the little person who had lived and grown inside her body. To stroke the tiny hands and feet that she'd grabbed at as they pushed against her stomach from inside. To watch the little lips, pursed as if about to speak. An expression of infinite wisdom, as if in those first days of life the small person retained the knowledge of a lifetime just past. Then in the middle